The programme was recorded in front of an audience at the Chelsea Physic Garden, London.
My working life has been all but filled by two predominant concerns, education and the environment. As a teacher of English and drama for 10 years, and an environmentalist for nigh on 20 years, there's not been a lot of time in between, apart from family and friends. It's hard to say where it all started, but I realise now that the countless childhood hours spent wandering around on Hampstead Heath, or poring over animal magazines whenever I could lay my hands on them, were all part of the picture. For an impressionable 8-year-old, Hampstead Heath had all the magic and potential of an uncharted jungle. And Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book may well have encouraged me to see myself as a latter-day Mowgli. I certainly had no difficulty imagining my way into his account of Mowgli's upbringing with the wolf pack that had rescued him.
"Take him away," he said to Father Wolf, "and train him as befits one of the free people." And that is how Mowgli was entered into the Seeonee wolf pack. Now you must be content to skip 10 or 11 whole years and only guess at all the wonderful life that Mowgli led among the wolves, because if it were written out, it would fill ever so many books. He grew up with the cubs, though they, of course, were grown wolves almost before he was a child. And Father Wolf taught him his business and the meaning of things in the jungle till every rustle in the grass, every breath of the warm night air, every note of the owls above his head, every scratch of a bat's claws as it roosted for a while in a tree, and every splash of every little fish jumping in a pool, meant just as much to him as the work of his office meant to a businessman. When he was not learning, he sat out in the sun and slept, and ate, and went to sleep again. When he felt dirty or hot, he swam in the forest pools. And he grew and grew strong as a boy must grow who does not know that he is learning any lessons and who has nothing in the world to think of except things to eat.
This rather concentrated diet of animal stories and magazines was, of course, leavened by a few of the staples. Swallows and Amazons was never far away, and the famous Five filled many happy hours. Now, for those who are not familiar with the somewhat hearty activities of this quintet, Alan Corran's version of the famous Five, reenacting Hamlet, will give a pretty clear picture. And this is the only time during the course of the next hour when I actually get a walk-on part, albeit as the dog.
Five go off to Elsinore, by William Shakespeare, Act 1, Scene 1, Cheam, a desert country near the sea, before the gates of the Laburnums. Alarums off. Enter Julian.
Hung be the heavens with black, yield day to night. The halls are but a short week old, and now there comes such news as Hecate herself would quake to hear of. 5 years of study gone, and now I learn that all I have to show is 2 O-levels, 1 English, 1 Maths. 5 subjects failed, and I, 1 subject felled by failure to as fell a fall as folly here.
Enter Timmy, a dog.
Ah, Timmy, had I but the joy of e'en thy meanest flea, I were in luck.
Ruff, ruff.
Unmetric.
Ruff, 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 ruff.
The very dogs do bend them to my pleas, though men do wreck me not. But yet I'm wrecked.
Enter Georgina. Oh, now, sweet cuz, I am this sec arrived from Cheltenham Ladies' College for the VAC. And we shall do such things, we famous five. Find maps, thwart thieves, have midnight feasts in ruined castles, smugglers' coves, and more deserted cottages than you've had, hot...
F off, Georgina! All has come to naught. A sound career with ICI is lost, and I must hie me with my measly 2 and seek emolument as clerk, grade 4. No longer mind the treehouse and the barge, the secret passage and... But ho, what comes?
Enter Dick and Anne.
Look, dearest Anne, we five are now conjoined as one, like some great lion's sponge cake late divided, and now once more enseamed.
It is my younger brother. Dare I ask how he has fared in this last GCE? Hallo, sweet Dick. How goes the world with all?
With all, indeed. With all 6 subjects passed. Jog, maths, Inglit, French history, and stink.
Oh, ripping Dick, top hole, spot on. Good show.
This little twit shall yet undo me quite. Replace me in our father's roomy sight and get a Morris Minor for his pains, the dirty swat.
I say, chaps, what about a game of Harry Cricket?
Yes.
Ruff, ruff.
Enter cricket bag. Stumps are set up. Julian bowls the first ball to Dick, who smites it mightily. See, Timmy, run, run, Timmy, run. Oh, look, he's caught the ball between his teeth. Good dog. Timmy dies.
That ball, 'tis poisoned. It was meant for me. But what about this bat?
'Tis poisoned too.
Then have at thee, foul villain. Take thou that.
Ah, a poisoned off-drive. Ah, I am slain.
Alas.
Julian dies.
And so am I. Oh, what a measly show.
Dick dies. Flourish. Enter bearers. They bear the bodies and exeunt.
Oh, well. The curse of thy 11+, two brothers minus. Shall it I be thus?
I can't remember which of my teachers it was who first introduced me to the delights of parody, but I owe them a great deal in terms of my subsequent love of teaching. They were the very opposite of Thomas Gradgrind, one of Charles Dickens's more memorable acts of revenge on the teaching profession.
Thomas Gradgrind, sir, a man of realities, a man of facts and calculations, a man who proceeds upon the principle that 2 and 2 are 4 and nothing over, and who is not to be talked into allowing for anything over. Thomas Gradgrind, sir, peremptorily Thomas. Thomas Gradgrind. With a rule and a pair of scales and a multiplication table always in his pocket, sir. Ready to weigh any measure, any parcel of human nature and tell you exactly what it comes to. It is a mere question of figures, a case of simple arithmetic. In such terms, no doubt, substituting the words boys and girls for sir, Thomas Gradgrind now presented Thomas Gradgrind to the little pitchers before him who were to be filled so full of facts. Indeed, as he eagerly sparkled at them from the cellarage before mentioned, he seemed a kind of cannon loaded to the muzzle with facts and prepared to blow them clean out of the regions of childhood at one discharge. He seemed a galvanizing apparatus, too, charged with a grim mechanical substitute for the tender young imaginations that were to be stormed away. Girl number 20, said Mr. Gradgrind, squarely pointing with his square forefinger. I don't know that girl. Who is that girl?
Sissy Jupe, sir,
explained number 20, blushing, standing up, and curtsying. Sissy's not a name, said Mr. Gradgrind. Don't call yourself Sissy. Call yourself Cecilia.
His father calls me Sissy, sir,
returned the young girl in a trembling voice and with another curtsy. Then he has no business to do it, said Mr. Gradgrind. Tell him he mustn't. Cecilia Jupe. Let me see. What is your father?
He belongs to the horse riding, if you please, sir.
Mr. Gradgrind frowned and waved off the objectionable calling with his hand. We don't want to know everything about that here. You mustn't tell us about that here. Your father breaks horses, don't he?
If you please, sir, when they can get any to break, they do break horses in the ring, sir.
You mustn't tell us about the ring here. Very well, then. Describe your father as a horse breaker. He doctors sick horses, I dare say.
Oh, yes, sir.
Very well, then. He's a veterinary surgeon, a farrier and horsebreaker. Give me your definition of a horse.
Sissy Jupe, thrown into the greatest alarm by this demand.
Girl number 20, unable to define a horse, said Mr. Gradgrind, for the general behoof of all the little pitchers. Girl number 20, possessed of no facts in reference to one of the commonest of animals. Some boy's definition of a horse. A bit, sir, yours.
The square finger, moving here and there, lighted suddenly on Bitzer, perhaps because he chanced to sit in the same ray of sunlight which, darting in at one of the bare windows of the intensely whitewashed room, irradiated Sissy.
Bitzer, said Thomas Gradgrind, your definition of a horse?
Quadruped, graminivorous, 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, 4 eye teeth and 12 incisive. Sheds caught in the spring. In marshy countries, sheds hoofs too. Hoofs hard, but requiring to be shod with iron. Age known by marks in mouth.
Thus, and much more, Bitzer.
Now, girl number 20, said Mr. Gradgrind, you know what a horse is.
She curtsied again, and would have blushed deeper if she could have blushed deeper than she had blushed all this time.
with nothing but a degree in French and German, and no facts whatsoever about the business of actually teaching English, I must say that I relied a fair amount on intuition as a teacher. Inspired, no doubt, partly by my mother, who to this day can still remember vast chunks of poetry that have long since departed my faulty memory. Shelley's Ozymandias, for instance.
I met a traveller from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, 'My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.'" Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
Finding ways of teaching poetry is one of the most challenging aspects of an English teacher's life. From nonsense poems, for the sheer fun of it, such as this short extract from Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky.
"'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious bandersnatch."
All the way from such linguistic fun and games to more serious poems of love and war, such as Wilfred Owen's Dulce et Decorum Est.
"Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped five nines that dropped behind. Gas. Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling, and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If, in some smothering dreams, you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil's, sick of sin. If you could hear, at every jolt, the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori."
During my 10 years as a teacher, I gradually got more and more involved in environmental or green issues. My choice of authors in the classroom may occasionally have reflected this, as I felt increasingly impelled, and encouraged, I might add, by a very enlightened head teacher, to challenge the values that hold sway in our consumer-driven society. Thus, Philip Larkin's Going, Going remains a favourite.
I thought it would last my time, the sense that beyond the town there would always be fields and farms, where the village louts could climb such trees as were not cut down. I knew there'd be false alarms in the papers about old streets and split-level shopping, but some have always been left so far. And when the old part retreats, as the bleak high-rises come, we can always escape in the car. Things are tougher than we are, just as Earth will always respond, however we mess it about. chuck filth in the sea if you must. The tides will be clean beyond. But what do I feel now? Doubt? Or age, simply? The crowd is young in the M1 cafe. Their kids are screaming for more houses, more parking allowed, more caravan sites, more pay. On the business page, a score of spectacled grins approve some takeover bid that entails 5% profit and 10% more in the estuaries. Move your works to the unspoilt dales, grey area grants, and when you try to get near the sea in summer. It seems just now to be happening so very fast. Despite all the land left free, for the first time I feel somehow that it isn't going to last. That before I snuff it, the whole boiling will be bricked in, except for the tourist parts. First slum of Europe. A role it won't be so hard to win with a cast of crooks and tarts. And that will be England gone. The shadows, the meadows, the lanes, the guild halls, the carved choirs. There'll be books. It will linger on in galleries. But all that remains for us will be concrete and tires. Most things are never meant. This won't be, most likely. But greeds and garbage are too thick strewn to be swept up now, or invent excuses that make them all needs. I just think it will happen. Soon.
One of the more sobering things that such authors have taught me is that there's actually nothing new in today's environmental concern. The character of Astroff, for instance, in Chekhov's Uncle Vanya, manages to tell us as much about protecting forests and about the phenomenon of global warming as all the international conferences on those subjects put together.
The Russian forests are literally groaning under the axe. Millions of trees are being destroyed. Man is endowed with reason and creative power, so that he can increase what has been given him. But up to the present, he's been destroying and not creating. There are fewer and fewer forests. The rivers are drying up. The wild creatures are almost exterminated. The climate is being ruined. And the land is getting poorer and more hideous every day. I can see your ironic expression, and I believe that what I say doesn't seem at all serious to you. And, oh, maybe it is just crankiness. All the same, when I go walking by the woods that belong to the peasants, the woods I saved from being cut down, or when I hear the rustling of the young trees I planted with my own hands, I'm conscious of the fact that the climate is to some extent in my power too. And that if mankind is happy in 1,000 years' time, I'll be responsible for it, even though only to a very minute extent. When I plant a little birch tree and then see it growing green and swaying in the wind, my heart fills with pride, and I... However, it's time for me to go. After all, that's probably just my crankiness. Permit me to take my leave.
Of course, working the land isn't always as uplifting a process as many city dwellers assume it to be. In one of Thomas Hardy's most despair-inducing novels, poor Tessa the D'Urbervilles experiences a very low point in her life at Flintcomb Ash Farm.
There was no exaggeration in Marion's definition of Flintcomb Ash Farm as a starve-acre place. The swede field in which Tess and her companion were set hacking was a stretch of 100-odd acres in one patch on the highest ground of the farm. The upper half of each turnip had been eaten off by the livestock, and it was the business of the two women to grub up the lower or earthy half of the root with a hooked fork called a hacker, that it might be eaten also. Every leaf of the vegetable having already been consumed, the whole field was in colour a desolate drab. It was a complexion without features, as if a face from chin to brow should be only an expanse of skin. The sky wore in another colour the same lightness, a white vacuity of countenance with the lineaments gone. So these two upper and nether visages confronted each other all day long, the white face looking down on the brown face, and the brown face looking up at the white face, without anything standing between them but the two girls crawling over the surface of the former like flies. They worked on, hour after hour, unconscious of the forlorn aspect they bore in the landscape, not thinking of the justice or injustice of their lot. Even in such a position as theirs, it was possible to exist in a dream. In the afternoon, the rain came on again, and Marian said that they need not work any more. But if they did not work, they would not be paid. So they worked on. It was so high a situation, this field, that the rain had no occasion to fall, but raced along horizontally upon the yelling wind, sticking into them like glass splinters till they were wet through. Tess had not known till now what was really meant by that. There are degrees of dampness, and a very little is called being wet through in common talk. But to stand working slowly in a field and feel the creep of rainwater, first in legs and shoulders, and then on hips and head, then at back, front and sides, and yet to work on till the leaden light diminishes and marks that the sun is down, demands a distinct modicum of stoicism, even of valour.
In a quite different way, different even from Hardy's many lyrical accounts of the countryside around Dorchester, D.H. Lawrence positively revelled in celebrating the richness and sensuality of the earth, which he himself had experienced as a boy in the Nottinghamshire countryside. In Sons and Lovers, Paul, who is actually D.H. Lawrence himself, and Miriam experience a moment of extraordinary intensity.
One evening in the summer, Miriam and he went over the fields by Herod's farm on their way from the library home. There was a yellow glow over the mowing grass, and the sorrel heads burned crimson. Gradually, as they walked along the high land, the gold in the west sank down to red, the red to crimson, and then the chill blue crept up against the glow. The pair stood, loath to part, hugging their books. "The wood is so lovely now," she said. "I wanted you to see it." He followed her slowly across the road to the white gate. "They grumble so if I'm late," he said. "But you're not doing anything wrong," she answered impatiently. He followed her across the nibbled pasture in the dusk. There was a coolness in the wood, a scent of leaves, of honeysuckle, and a twilight. The two walked in silence. Night came wonderfully there, among the throng of dark trunks. He looked round, expectant. She wanted to show him a certain wild rose bush she had discovered. She knew it was wonderful. And yet, till he had seen it, she felt it had not come into her soul. Only he could make it her own, immortal. She was dissatisfied. When they turned the corner of the path, she stood still. In the wide walk between the pines, gazing rather frightened, she could distinguish nothing for some moments. The graying light robbed things of their colour. And then she saw her bush. "Ah!" she cried, hastening forward. It was very still. The tree was tall and straggling. It had thrown its briars over a hawthorn bush, and its long streamers trailed thick right down to the grass, splashing the darkness everywhere with great split stars, pure white. In bosses of ivory and in large, splashed stars, the roses gleamed on the darkness of foliage and stems and grass. Paul and Miriam stood close together, silent, and watched. Point after point, the steady roses shone out of them, seeming to kindle something in their souls. The dusk came like smoke around, and still did not put out the roses. Paul looked into Miriam's eyes. She was pale and expectant with wonder. Her lips were parted, and her dark eyes lay open to him. His look seemed to travel down into her. Her soul quivered. It was the communion she wanted. He turned aside as if pained. "Till Sunday," he said quietly, and left her. And she walked home slowly, feeling her soul satisfied with the holiness of the night. He stumbled down the path, and as soon as he was out of the wood, in the free, open meadow, where he could breathe, he started to run as fast as he could. It was like a delicious delirium in his veins.
D.H. Lawrence was also a wonderful poet of the natural world, and this poem, about the mosquito, brings back very painful memories of a night that Sarah, my wife and I, spent in a baking hotel room in Rome, either asphyxiating with the windows closed or being terrorized by mosquitoes with the windows open, a dilemma that I'm sure has been shared by many travelers.
I hate the way you lurch off sideways into air, having read my thoughts against you. Come then, let us play at unawares and see who wins in this sly game of bluff, man or mosquito. You don't know that I exist, and I don't know that you exist. Now then, it is your trump. It is your hateful little trump, you pointed fiend, which shakes my sudden blood to hatred of you. It is your small, high, hateful bugle in my ear. Why do you do it? Surely it is bad policy. They say you can't help it. If that is so, then I believe a little in Providence protecting the innocent. But it sounds so amazingly like a slogan, a yell of triumph as you snatch my scalp. Blood. Red blood. Super magical forbidden liquor. I behold you stand for a second enspasmed in oblivion, obscenely ecstasied, sucking live blood. My blood. Such silence. Such suspended transport, such gorging, such obscenity of trespass. You stagger, as well as you may. Only your accursed hairy frailty, your own imponderable weightlessness, saves you, wafts you away on the very draught my anger makes in its snatching, away with a paean of derision, you winged blood-drop. Can I not overtake you? Are you one too many for me, winged victory? Am I not mosquito enough to out-mosquito you? Queer, what a big stain my sucked blood makes beside the infinitesimal faint smear of you. Queer, what a dim dark smudge you have disappeared into.
Ogden Nash is a poet who has a wonderfully idiosyncratic way of looking at the animal kingdom.
The Wombat. The wombat lives across the seas, among the far antipodes. He may exist on nuts and berries, or then again on missionaries. His distant habitat precludes conclusive knowledge of his moods, but I would not engage the wombat in any form of mortal combat.
The llama. The one El Llama, he's a priest. The two El Llama, he's a beast. And I will bet a silk pyjama there isn't any 3L llama.
The camel. The camel has a single hump. The dromedary, too. Or else the other way around. I'm never sure. Are you?
The turtle. The turtle lives twixt plated decks which practically conceal its sex. I think it clever of the turtle in such a fix to be so fertile.
In his thoroughly enlightening book, Man and the Natural World, Keith Thomas explains some of the origins of the way in which we still treat animals today.
It was with human needs in mind that the animals had been carefully designed and distributed.
Camels,
observed a preacher in 1696,
had been sensibly allotted to Arabia, where there was no water, and savage beasts sent to deserts, where they may do less harm.
It was a sign of God's providence that fierce animals were less prolific than domestic ones, and that they lived in dens by day, usually coming out only at night when men were in bed. Moreover, whereas members of wild species are all looked alike, cows, horses, and other domestic animals had been conveniently variegated in colour and shape.
In order that mankind may the more readily distinguish and claim their respective property.
The physician George Cheney, in 1705, explained that
the Creator made the horse's excrement smell sweet because he knew that men would often be in its vicinity.
Every animal was thus intended to serve some human purpose, if not practical, then moral or aesthetic. Savage beasts were necessary instruments of God's wrath, left among us
to be our schoolmasters,
thought James Pilkington, the Elizabethan bishop.
They fostered human courage and provided useful training for war.
Horseflies, guessed the Virginian gentleman, William Byrd, in 1728,
had been created so that men should exercise their wits and industry to guard themselves against them.
Apes and parrots had been ordained
for man's mirth.
Singing birds were devised
on purpose to entertain and delight mankind.
The lobster, observed the Elizabethan George Owen, served several purposes in one.
It provided men with food, for they could eat its flesh,
with exercise, for they had first to crack its legs and claws, and with an object of contemplation, for they could behold its wonderful suit of armour, with its tasses, ventresses, pauldrons, couches, gauntlets, and gorgets, curiously wrought and forged by the most admirable workmen of the world.
God created the ox and the horse.
To labour in our service,
said the naturalist William Swainson. The dog,
to display affectionate attachment.
And the chicken,
to show perfect contentment in a state of partial confinement.
The louse was
indispensable,
explained the Reverend William Kirby,
because it provided a powerful incentive to habits of cleanliness.
At the other end of that particular scale is the view that all creatures have intrinsic value in themselves, regardless of their usefulness to us. Now, there have been few advocates of the rights of other creatures quite as eloquent and passionate as William Blake, here with an extract from Auguries of Innocence.
To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. A robin redbreast in a cage puts all heaven in a rage. A dove house filled with doves and pigeons shudders hell through all its regions. A dog starved at his master's gate predicts the ruin of the state. A horse misused upon the road calls to heaven for human blood. Each outcry of the hunted hare a fibre from the brain does tear. A skylark wounded in the wing, a cherubim does cease to sing.
Among today's modern poets, Ted Hughes has an unerring way of capturing the detail and the self-contained dignity of many different creatures, which I must say I used to draw on very heavily as a teacher. This one, The Horses, remains one of my favourites.
I climb through woods in the hour before dawn dark. Evil air, a frost-making stillness, not a leaf, not a bird, a world cast in frost. I came out above the wood where my breath left torture statues in the iron light. But the valleys were draining the darkness till the moorline blackening dregs of the brightening grey halved the sky ahead. And I saw the horses, huge in the dense grey, 10 together, megalith still. They breathed, making no move, with draped manes and tilted hind hooves, making no sound. I passed. Not one snorted or jerked its head. Grey, silent fragments of a grey, silent world. I listened in emptiness on the moor ridge. The curlew's tear turned its edge on the silence. Slowly detail leafed from the darkness. Then the sun, orange, red, red erupted silently, and splitting to its core, tore and flung cloud, shook the gulf open, showed blue, and the big planets hanging. I turned, stumbling in the fever of a dream, down towards the dark woods from the kindling tops, and came to the horses. There still they stood, but now steaming and glistening under the flow of light, their draped stone manes, their tilted hind hooves, stirring under a thaw, while all around them the frost showed its fires. But still they made no sound. Not one snorted or stamped, their hung heads patient as the horizons, high over valleys in the red levelling rays. In din of the crowded streets, going among the years, the faces, may I still meet my memory in so lonely a place, between the streams and the red clouds, hearing curlews, hearing the horizons endure.
The poetry of R.S. Thomas applies some of the same robust and telling insights to the people, the characters who make up the countryside. People like Job Davis in his poem entitled Law.
Job Davis, 85 winters old and still alive after the slow poison and treachery of the seasons. Miserable? Kick my arse. It needs more than the rain's hearse, wind-drawn, to pull me off the great perch of my laugh. What's living but courage? Paunch full of hot porridge, nerves strengthened with tea, peat black. Dawn found me mowing where the grass grew, bearded with golden dew. Rhythm of the long scythe kept this tall frame lithe. What to do? Stay green. Never mind the machine whose fuel is human souls. Live large, man, and dream small.
Stay green, never mind the machine. It sometimes seems to me that for all the amazing advances that we've made, some of the best things about our lives are indeed being crushed by the juggernaut of industrialism. Now, my first intimation of this came nearly 20 years ago when I read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, a book which remains one of the most powerful indictments of man's abuse of the natural world that I've ever read. The focus of Silent Spring was the widespread use of DDT and other pesticides.
The current vogue for poisons has failed utterly to take into account these most fundamental considerations. As crude a weapon as the caveman's club, the chemical barrage has been hurled against the fabric of life, a fabric on the one hand delicate and destructible, on the other miraculously tough and resilient, and capable of striking back in unexpected ways. These extraordinary capacities of life have been ignored by the practitioners of chemical control, who have brought to their task no high-minded orientation, no humility before the vast forces with which they tamper. The control of nature is a phrase conceived in arrogance, born of the Neanderthal age of biology and philosophy, when it was supposed that nature exists for the convenience of man. The concepts and practices of applied entomology, for the most part, date from that Stone Age of science. It is our alarming misfortune that so primitive a science has armed itself with the most modern and terrible weapons, and that in turning them against the insects, it has also turned them against the earth.
Of course, one of the great joys of having children is the opportunity to rediscover all the literary delights of one's own childhood. There's quite a sense of relief in our household that our 2-year-old daughter seems to be almost as dotty about Winnie the Pooh as we ourselves apparently were. So on the off chance that she may actually be listening in, here is the anxious Pooh song, in which Pooh, having rescued Piglet from the flood, but experiencing a sudden identity crisis, finds this dream singing itself in his head.
3 cheers for Pooh.
For who?
For Pooh.
Why, what did he do?
I thought you knew. He saved his friend from a wetting. 3 cheers for Bear.
For where?
For Bear. He couldn't swim, but he rescued him.
He rescued who?
Oh, listen, do. I'm talking of Pooh.
Of who?
Of Pooh.
I'm sorry, I keep forgetting.
Well, Pooh was a bear of enormous brain.
Just say it again.
Of enormous brain.
Of enormous what?
Well, he ate a lot, and I don't know if he could swim or not, but he managed to float on a sort of boat.
On a sort of what?
Well, a sort of pot. So now let's give him 3 hearty cheers.
So now let's give him 3 hearty witches.
And hope he'll be with us for years and years, and grow in health and wisdom and riches. 3 cheers for Pooh.
For who?
For Pooh. 3 cheers for Bear.
For where?
For Bear. 3 cheers for the wonderful Winnie the Pooh.
Just tell me, somebody, what did he do?
Now, just as Alan Corrin gave the famous 5 and Shakespeare a hard time earlier on in the programme, here he does the same for Pooh, this time imagining what would happen if Ernest Hemingway had set out to write a Pooh story.
It snowed hard that winter. It was the winter they all went up to the front. You could get up early in the morning if you were not wounded and forced to lie in your bed and look at the ceiling and wonder about the thing with the women, and you could see them going up to the front in the snow. When they walked in the snow, they left tracks. And after they'd gone, the snow would come down again, and pretty soon the tracks would not be there anymore. That is the way it is with snow. Pooh did not go up to the front that winter, nor did he lie in bed and look at the ceiling, although last winter he had lain in bed and looked up at the ceiling, because that was the winter he had gone up to the front and got his wound. But it snowed that winter, too. This winter he could walk around. It was one of those wounds that left you able to walk around. It was one of those wounds that did not leave you much more. Pooh got up, and he went out into the snow, and he went to see Piglet. Piglet had been one of the great ones once. Piglet had been one of the Pujadas, one of the Andarillos, one of the Nogales. He had been one of the greatest Nogales there'd ever been.
But he was not one of the greatest Nogales anymore. He did not go up to the front either. Piglet was sitting at his usual table, looking at an empty glass of anjarda. I thought you were out, said Pooh. No, said Piglet, I was not out. You were thinking about the wound, said Pooh. No, said Piglet, I was not thinking about the wound. I do not think about the wound very much anymore. They watched them going up to the front in the snow. We could go and see Eeyore, said Pooh. Yes, said Piglet, we could go and see Eeyore. They went out into the snow. Do you hear the guns, said Pooh?